dog. You did some time in the cat jail for less time. You didn't like the way your tan was
in the morning. Excuse me, is this thing on?
Oh, whoa, whoa.
Yeah.
Excuse me.
You're welcome.
Guitar up.
One,
turn
two,
that guitar
three.
Up.
Welcome to In the Studio. I'm Redbeard, bringing you the stories behind the making of the greatest rock albums in history. Today we'll go in the studio with the album that introduced the world to a band that would become a legend.
I think everyone was inspired in that band. Everyone was a star, you know. There wasn't a weakness there, you know. Every single person was strong. Hi there, this is Jimmy Page in the studio.
Hello, I'm Robert Plant in the studio for Led Zeppelin 1.
The sound of it, to some people, was frightening. Too powerful to be trusted, too potent to ignore. It was the sound of rock and roll entering a new era. A sound that went beyond pop music, beyond psychedelia, beyond the notion of electrified blues. It was loud and angry, ominous and irresistible, the culmination of everything that had gone before it. It was music filled with thunder, and it's been 20 years since it was first unleashed. 20 years since the sound of Led Zeppelin shook the world. The man who created that sound was a shy guitar wizard named Jimmy Page. For years, Page had been developing a reputation as a gifted and innovative guitarist, first as a London studio player and then with the Yardbirds. Certainly, Robert Plant, John Paul Jones, and John Bonham were essential elements in Led Zeppelin's success. But it was Page who was primarily responsible for the stunning range of sounds on Led Zeppelin 1. The distorted tones, the echoes, the sheer power of it all. Today, the sound effects and guitar techniques that he used have become commonplace, almost cliches. But in 1968, Jimmy Page was doing things with guitar sounds that no one had ever done before.
Yeah, I had an idea of exactly what I wanted to do with the first album and the band. There's a lot of contrast on the album, and that's one of the things that I really wanted to get together, which I didn't think anyone else was doing, and that was the... But then again, you know, that's the way it shaped up. But fortunately, it shaped up the way that I, you know, hoped it was going to.
That's Good Times, Bad Times from Led Zeppelin 1. Jimmy Page was a legend in London recording circles long before the rest of the world knew his name. He was the preeminent studio guitarist of his day, playing on hundreds of sessions in 1964 and 65, adding uncredited guitar licks to records by The Who, The Kinks, Donovan, and many others. The word was that if Page couldn't play it, it couldn't be played.
Yeah, I just developed different styles of guitar through that, actually, with the discipline of the studio and then my interest on guitar. And I've been very keen on acoustic guitar playing anyway, fingerstyle playing. Oh boy, I was on all manner of things, you know, jazz sessions. You'd be surprised what I played on. There was less guitar being played as such. I mean, as far as any sort of lyrical guitar being played, I was just sort of strumming along virtually, and I got fed up with it. I've got to also say that 90% of the studio work that I got booked in on, I didn't know what I was going to be doing. You know, they'd just say, bring such and such an instrument, and I didn't know it could be anything. I mean, if it was an acoustic guitar, it could have been a folk session, it could have been just, you know, just acoustic within an orchestra, or it could have, you know, anything, you know. But the thing that finished it off for me was got to this one date, and it was a Muzak session. Muzak's the sort of stuff you hear played in hotel lobbies. That's right, Jimmy Page was booked in to do that, and I said to the guy afterwards who used to be called a fixer. And I said, well, don't ever do that to me again. There were so many other guitarists, so I was the youngest guitarist, but there's so many others who could have just fitted that session. And I had a hard time reading all that music on there too, because once they start, they count you in, 1, 2, 3, 4, off you go, and you have to turn and keep reading. And I thought, this isn't what I'm all about. made my mind up that it was time to go. So I got out of that. And it just so happened at that point of time, that's when the Yardbirds opportunity came up for the second time round. But this time I took it.
Jimmy Page had first been asked to join the Yardbirds in March 1965 when Eric Clapton left the band. Jimmy declined then, instead recommending his friend Jeff Beck. But in the spring of 1966, Page got a second chance.
It just so happened there was an incredible bust-up one night and the bass player left. He was advising the drummer to leave as well, but he didn't want to leave. But he was adamant he wasn't going to carry on, and they had no bass player, so I said, okay, well, look, Jeff and I on the way home were talking in the car, and I said, well, look, if you like, you know, I'll come in on bass, because he'd always wanted me to come in the Yardbirds, but it was always known as Five Live Yardbirds. Well, there's an album, Five Live Yardbirds. I said, we can't do that, you know, you can't change that whole thing and have six just because we want to play together. But suddenly there was, the opportunity was there, so I took over the bass, and the whole idea was that the rhythm guitarist would learn the bass, and then we could get on with playing some dual lead guitars.
Beck left the Yardbirds in 1967, and what was left of the band had essentially disintegrated by the spring of 1968. But even as the Yardbirds came apart, Page was coming into his own, writing new songs, experimenting with new techniques, anxious to try them in a recording studio.
When Jeff left the Yardbirds, and it was left with just the four of us, and within the frameworks of those numbers, there was a lot of free-form improvisation, and I'd come up with a lot of riffs as the numbers had changed. Obviously, I wasn't playing the riffs that he played in those particular numbers, anyway, the free-form ones. Obviously, I had to do the same riffs for Over, Under, Sideways, Down. But, constantly I was developing all these different ideas, and I'd been playing with the bow and all that sort of thing. And I was extremely interested in acoustic music, finger-picking music. And I wanted to tie all this stuff up with some ideas as well with the recorded aspect of it, to have more ambience. And then I had this idea, Backwards Echo, which I'd actually suggested before on a Yardbirds track, which we used. And I knew it worked. So just different ideas that I had, and just really wanted to see if it could work, you know, and it did. The idea of it was there was going to be a lot of light and shade on the album, but also there would be like a sort of tension, dramatic tension.
I can't quit you, babe. That's Willie Dixon's classic blues, I Can't Quit You, Baby, arranged by Jimmy Page and recorded by a band that was first called the New Yardbirds. When we come back, we'll tell you how that band was formed. I'm Redbeard, and you're in the studio for Led Zeppelin 1.
Welcome back to In the Studio for Led Zeppelin. I'm Robert Plant.
And I'm Redbeard. After the Yardbirds broke up in 1968, Jimmy Page was offered the chance to do one last Yardbirds tour, so he put together a new band, which was called the New Yardbirds. Page's first choice for lead singer was named Terry Reid.
I wanted somebody who could really belt out the blues and, well, rock really, but blues, but also be able to handle other, well, you know, subtleties as well. So it needed somebody with a really, really good vocal range and power. I called him up and he'd already signed to us for a solo career. But he suggested there's this guy who's a really good blues singer and he plays harp. He lives in the Midlands. He gave me his name. I tracked Robert down and went to go and see him. That was it.
And this is Robert Plant.
He came to see me. I was playing in a band. Yes, I remember it all now. And he came up to me and he said, where's Robert Plant? And I said, why? He said, well, I've come up to see him. I said, well, who are you? And he said, Jimmy Page. I said, who are you then? You know, I was one of those sort of things. He thought I was the roadie, and I wasn't going to tell him I knew who he was.
Did you know of Jimmy's reputation at the time when you first met him?
Well, I knew what he did. I knew what band he was in.
Did it intimidate you at all?
No. Well, I was 19. You know, I mean, I was fed up at fixing the roads and working on a Saturday and a Sunday, you know. I mean, it was nice to meet anybody who's... And when I heard him play,
it was such a celebration. I keep using that word, but it was great. He was somebody who could play the blues with an attitude that wasn't just black. It was very much London art school, that kind of attitude, the kind of aggressive, angular thing. Very good, I like it.
In addition to Plan, Page recruited John Paul Jones, a veteran London session musician, to play bass and keyboards, and finally, a drummer that Plan had recommended, John Bonzo Bonham.
Jonesy called me up and said, you're getting a band together. He said, I'd really like to be part of it. And obviously we knew each other from the session days, because he was one of the young players as well. He was the youngest bass player on the thing. At the time, I had a couple of drummers in mind, but Robert said, I know a really good drummer in the Midlands, Bonzo. So we went up to see him. Oh, we saw him in London, actually. He was playing with Tim Rose. I thought, yeah, OK. It took ages to get Bonzo to actually agree to come and be part of it, because he had a steady job with Tim Rose, you see. He was just exactly the type of drummer I was looking for. If I mentioned the drummers that I liked, you wouldn't know them anyway, the ones that I was thinking of. In fact, I couldn't get hold of them. But it was really, you know, a real, you know, powerhouse drummer. That's what it needed. That's a backbone of a band, is a powerhouse drummer. Eventually, we managed to get the four of us into one room, and that was it. It just exploded.
Indeed it did. It was the first week of September 1968 when the four of them played together for the first time. They were a curious mix. The experienced London session men, and the untested talents from the Midlands. Robert Plant remembers.
Well, yeah, I was pretty green, you know. I mean, I didn't know which fork to use when, but who cared? It didn't matter. You know, it was our contribution that counted. Without Bonzo, the band wouldn't have meant anything at all. Sure, I mean, he was the emulsifying agent, he was everything. He was the whole core of the thing. He was the guy who stopped it being just another rock band, really. At least in its performance, the writing. I mean, Jimmy's approach was so unique and is so unique. But, I mean, Bonzo's whole delivery was the thing that made it what it is, was, and always will be.
The first song they played, These New Yardbirds, was Train Kept A-Rollin'. 20 years later, the moment is etched in Robert Plant's memory.
We were in a tiny weeny room with all this equipment, not really knowing what on earth we'd do and what on earth it would be like, and we just started playing, and it was like powerful stuff, you know. And we all knew then that this thing, no matter how it was exposed to people, primarily when you play music, you've got to please yourself. You know, you can't look at the chart or whatever it is and say, I've got to be there for that reason. And we knew this thing that we got here would kind of clear a lot of crap out of the way. It was like a big, big hammer going. And that was it.
That's Communication Breakdown, cited by many as the very first heavy metal song. Next, we'll hear how Led Zeppelin's first appearance in America left the critics dazed and confused. I'm Red Beard, and you're in the studio for Led Zeppelin 1.
Hi there, this is Jimmy Page in the studio for Led Zeppelin 1.
And I'm Red Beard. Welcome back. When the New Yardbirds returned to England from their Scandinavian tour in mid-September 1968, they knew they were on to something remarkable. The name of the band was quickly changed, and the first Led Zeppelin album was recorded in South London in October 1968, barely a month after their first rehearsal. Amazing. By the end of December, they would be touring America for the first time, and in January 1969, Led Zeppelin 1 was released. Here's Jimmy Page.
I knew it was really good, what we were doing. Good Lord, I knew it was good. We did a few dates in England, quite a few, actually. And I don't know what the undercurrent was, but, it was just like, yeah, they're okay. But it wasn't until we got over here and played at, I think it was the Fillmore, that suddenly we went in right at the right time, because there was Country Joe and the Fish were on. And of course, you know, all those sort of family bands like that. And Taj Mahal, I believe, was on that. And I'm not sure, I think so. But all those bands had become so sort of, like, it was like a big family, you know. And suddenly we just went in there and started off with all this stuff, and they just didn't know what had hit them. And they just went wild, and then suddenly there was this wildfire just spread across America. There's this band that's up there, and it's, you know, it's really happening.
Been dazed and confused for so long, it's not true. Wanted a woman never...
Jimmy Page's guitar solo on Dazed and Confused became a high point of Zeppelin live shows. On parts of the song, he played the guitar with a violin bow.
The bow, I used to use it in that. Well, with the Yardbirds, we used to do that, and I'm a Man. That was one of their hits over here, but I used to use the bow in that as well. I didn't do anything provided it made the guitar sound different. You know, the funniest thing about all of this bow business is, you know, David McCallum, his father was a session violinist over there, and he's the one who suggested about this bow business. Have you ever tried bowing the guitar? And I said, no, I haven't. I said, well, I don't think it'd be very easy because, like, a violin has got an arched, you know, an arched neck, so to speak, and an arched bridge. The guitar doesn't, you see. But he said, well, have a go, and I tried it. And in fact, It was the thing that gave me the idea to do it.
Zeppelin's debut album, at first anyway, went relatively unnoticed in Britain. It was in America, where the band played three tours in 1969 alone, that the frenzy really took hold. But Robert Plant says the response in England was greater than some people think.
Now, the critics were lukewarm, but we played a storm. We had queues right three times around the block and stuff like that, playing in small clubs. It was big, it was real hot, and this whole thing about Zeppelin not having the same attractivity in Britain is wildly misinterpreted, because the whole thing about Britain is that it has a different attitude towards music anyway. It doesn't have the kind of intensity or the clamorous, magnetic quality that it does over here. People kind of, 5 days a week, people are a little cool about, you know. I mean, it's funny. It's the way of the beast, really. In Scandinavia, it's different again, you know. In Hong Kong, it's different. It's just a kind of national attitude to expressing yourself, you know. America really gets on with it and has a good time and throws its legs up in the air with gay abandon occasionally. Britain's a little more reserved, but it's still pretty hot.
In later years, Led Zeppelin would become the most popular rock band in the world, drawing larger crowds than any group in history. But in the beginning, the productions weren't quite so grand. Here's Robert Plant.
And we only had one guy looking after the band, driving the station wagon. So I did the PA as well. So I had to change the volume of the voice from the stage. So nobody had any idea of whether the voice was loud enough or not. You just took pot luck. And I've heard bootlegs from San Francisco, from Fillmore. And it's terrible. It's terrible because I'm still fiddling around with this amplifier with its treble and its bass control thing, which I bought with me from the Band of Joy, which was totally inadequate and probably about as loud as the television set is these days. But it was about 150 watts. And now you don't even play without 1,500 watts at a rehearsal, or whatever it is, you know. So, I mean, it must have been a very funny sight. This guy with no shoes on and his wedding suit, pirouetting around, pulling all sorts of funny faces and also controlling the level of his own voice from a box which was placed in front of the bass drum, which was the amplifier. It was great. But that's how it was.
Led Zeppelin redefined the limits of rock and roll, magnified its power, its danger, and some of its faults. Not everyone noticed it at the time, but 20 years later, the music and its impact cannot be denied. Here's Jimmy Page.
I think everyone was inspired in that band. Everyone was a star, you know. There wasn't a weakness there, you know. Every single person was strong. And the chemistry of the four people put together was, we know what it is now. But at that time, I mean, this is that we're looking at the first album, and it's, you know, it's a mixture of, there's blues on it, and there's acoustic music, and there's, I mean, you've got Black Mountainside and instrumental, which is finger picking. Then you've got the extension of that type of thing with Babe, I'm Gonna Leave You, which starts with the acoustic, but it also has all this, you know, high power accents on it as well, electric accents, and a very dramatic quality, you know. I mean, I still think that holds up, you know. I think they will hold up.
Babe, baby, baby, I'm gonna leave you.
We'll be back in the studio after this. I'm Red Beard. Thanks to Jimmy Page and Robert Plant for taking us back to the days of their youth. We'd also like to thank Bill Kirbishley and Ann Weldon, Brian Good, Phil Carlos, Marco Babineau of Geffen Records. In the Studio is a Bullet production produced by yours truly, Red Beard, and Joe Rose, written by Joe Rose. Our engineer, Doug Hall. Digital mastering is done by Tom Cusick at Century 21 in Dallas. Thanks to Night Ranger for In the Studio theme. The executive producer of In the Studio is Steve Smith. Thank you for being with us. Please come back next week when we'll go behind the scenes of another landmark rock and roll album, In the Studio. Led Zeppelin. The beginning. The forging of the musical hammer. The real story this week in the studio.
I think everyone was inspired in that band. Everyone was a star, you know. There wasn't a weakness there, you know. Every single person was strong. Hi there, this is Jimmy Page in the studio.
Hello, I'm Robert Plant in the studio for Led Zeppelin 1.